This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. The United States continues to shatter records for daily new coronavirus cases and hospitalizations. The virus has infected more than 12 million Americans, killing over a quarter of a million. And experts say the crisis will not be contained until a majority of the population is inoculated against COVID-19. But when will that happen? How will San Antonio witness the biggest vaccination program in modern history? And are you ready to roll up your sleeve and get the shots? Why or why not? Call in. Tell us what you think about all of this process. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org, tweet at us at @TPRSource, and that number you can text us at 833-877-8255. Our call-in number, you can text us as well on that. So we're joined this afternoon by the San Antonio Metropolitan Health District's A-team. We've got Dr. Anita Kurian with us, the Assistant Director of Communicable Diseases for the San Antonio Metropolitan Health District. And Dr. Kurian, welcome to The Source.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Also with us, Dr. Sandra Guerra, Metro Health Interim Deputy Public Health Director. Dr. Guerra, welcome to The Source.
Thank you very much.
And also with us, Dr. Junda Wu, Medical Director for Metro Health. And Dr. Wu, it's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So Dr. Anita Kurian, we're going to have, apparently, eventually, we're going to have a massive inoculation program for San Antonio. And when I think many people, when we talk about a big vaccination program, they remember our history and they think about when we had things like the polio. And here's a clip of that.
Once the Public Health Service authorizes its release, the polio vaccine can begin to protect American youngsters. In 1955, over 10 million children received one or more injections of Salk vaccine, including this boy, the president's own grandson, David Eisenhower. And now, like millions of boys and girls across the nation, David, too, is protected against paralytic polio. Free to play and enjoy the delights of summertime with the president, his grandfather.
David Eisenhower, of course, is the person that Camp David is named after, and son-in-law for Richard Nixon, and had gone on to be, he still is alive, he's a famous historian. So, Dr. Kurian, is it going to be like that?
It is going to be like that, but not for a while just yet. So with COVID-19 vaccine, initially, we know the supply is going to be very limited, so there will be a phased approach to vaccinating everybody who needs the vaccine. And it will start with phase one, where we'll have constrained supply, and the vaccination will be highly targeted, targeting the priority groups. So at this time, the phase one priority groups are your healthcare workers. And healthcare workers themselves are being divided into two tiers. So once you're done with the priority population vaccination, and as the number of doses become more available, then a broader administration network will be required, and then that's when you'll see those mass vaccination efforts. So it'll be sometime later next year, but as soon as the vaccines become available, which we anticipate is going to be sometime in December, the supplies will be limited, and the administration will be very targeted, targeting those priority populations that have been laid out by CDC.
Dr. Guerra, so December, we could see the first vaccination program coming to San Antonio. It will be for vulnerable healthcare workers, to helping them in this case. And any idea when in December that might be?
Well, we are definitely working very closely with the state health department as well as the CDC to make sure that we are a community that is prepared to receive and distribute the vaccine into those priority groups. So we could be seeing it in mid to late December, and we are prepared to be able to run that effectively and make sure the right people get their vaccine and that we are able to maximize that opportunity as it becomes available.
And Dr. Junda Wu, Medical Director for Metro Health, I saw a headline says people need to know that getting the vaccine is not going to be a walk in the park, that I guess you could get some aches and pains. What should we expect if you get the vaccine?
Well, it's not any more than with other vaccines. So with all three, well, I'm sorry, we have data on the two mRNA-based vaccines, and those show that the most common side effects are just like with other kinds of shots, pain at the injection site, maybe some mild fatigue, muscle aches that go away after a short amount of time.
So Dr. Wu, can you talk about, so it's going to be two shots typically? I mean, that's what we're expecting. All three major vaccinations that have been announced have said it's going to require two shots. What does that mean?
They are, depending on the shot, it's either going to be 3 weeks apart or 4 weeks apart. There is one vaccine in the pipeline that requires only one shot. But it does mean that you have to get, not only that you're not protected, right, until you get that second one. The data that people got all excited about 95% protectiveness, happened at 1 to 2 weeks after that last dose. The other important thing is you can't mix and match. So you have to get the same shot the second time that you got the first time.
So how do we know which, so we have the Pfizer, the Moderna, there's the Oxford one as well. Which one will be getting here locally, or I guess will everyone be getting the same vaccine, Dr. Kurian?
I think it will depend from the data that we have and the information we have from the CDC at this time. It looks like Pfizer will be the first one out of the door. Pfizer has already submitted the paperwork for the fast track approval to FDA. It takes about 2 weeks or so for FDA to review the data and make recommendations to the Advisory Council of Immunization Practices. It takes a week for the ACIP then to review the data and make the recommendations to CDC. And then once CDC gets that information, it takes about a week or so for the vaccine to get into the arms of the people. So to the best of our knowledge, based on the information we have at this time today, Pfizer is the one that has turned in all the paperwork for the fast track approval to FDA. So it looks like Pfizer might be out of the door.
So Pfizer, that is the vaccination that has the more, it has to be colder. It has a tougher requirement.
That's correct. It has a very stringent storage and handling requirements. It needs the ultra cold storage.
And we're capable of dealing with that here locally.
It needs ultra storage capacity, which we don't have widely available at this time. It is very limited in San Antonio.
All right. So when we come back from this break, I'll ask more about that, because that certainly prompts more questions. And if you have some questions, we'd love to hear them. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You could also email us at thesource@tpr.org, tweet at us at @TPRSource. We'll be back with more questions, talking about COVID-19 vaccination implementation plan here for San Antonio Bexar County, here on The Source on Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. What do you want to know about San Antonio Metro Health's COVID-19 vaccination implementation plan? The city's top health experts are here on the line to answer all of your questions about the local vaccine distribution. And the number is 833-877-8255. You can also text us at that number. Patty is on the line. And Patty, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering if people who take biologic medicines for immune system disorders will be able to take these vaccines. Many of these, the biologics are TNF blockers, and I think that there's a connection with some of the vaccine, at least one, the AstraZeneca vaccine, that increases the T-cell production. Can your experts address that for me?
All right, Patty, thank you for the question. Dr. Junda Wu, Medical Director for Metro Health, I'm sure there are people who should not be taking the vaccine, right?
No, we don't have that information right now. There is some thought that a lot of these vaccines, including the mRNA ones as well, increase T-cell as well as B-cell production. I will say it's not the only vaccine to do that, though. And there are other vaccines that are, most vaccines are able to be taken by people with immune conditions. So we have to wait, but I'm optimistic that it would be fine to take it.
So as we're talking about the vaccine, and we're getting kind of excited that we might reach a point soon or soonish that this will be over, we can't get to can't take our eyes off the ball. We're still in a pandemic right now, and here's what Dr. Anthony Fauci had to say about that.
We now, as the vice president said, are telling you that help is on the way, which has two aspects to it. It means that we need to actually double down on the public health measures as we're waiting for that help to come, which will be soon. We'll be getting vaccine doses into people at high priority at the end of December. We're not talking about shutting down the country. We're not talking about locking down. We're talking about intensifying the simple public health measures that we all talk about. Mask wearing, staying distance, avoiding congregate settings, doing things to the extent that we can outdoors versus indoors. If we do that, we'll be able to hold things off until the vaccine comes. Now, I've used that metaphor that the cavalry is on the way. If you're fighting a battle and the cavalry is on the way, you don't stop shooting. You keep going until the cavalry gets here, and then you might even want to continue fighting.
Dr. Sandra Guetta, Metro Health Interim Deputy Public Health Director. Dr. Fauci is telling us we still have to take this very seriously right now.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. And I think our philosophy is that as a vaccine comes available, we are not going to stop our recommendations to the community to wear their masks and to continue to do social distancing and try and do everything that they can to protect themselves and their loved ones by being very mindful of the outings that they have and trying to only do those things that are essential for everyone's health and well-being. It is important to note that even as the vaccine comes available, public health will continue to do the work that they do in order to make sure that we identify the people who've been exposed to the virus. This is not a magic bullet that is going to suddenly, from one day to the next, make this pandemic go away. We will be fighting COVID for the good part of 2021 as we are implementing vaccination, as we're getting more people to get the vaccine, and making sure that all the other public health measures continue to work.
Let's go to the phone lines. The number is 833-877-8255 with Rick. Rick, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hey, I was just wondering if anyone has looked into whether or not it's safe for people that have already had the coronavirus, whether they knew it or not, to get the vaccines.
Good question, Rick. Thanks for that. So, Dr. Anita Kurian, what about Rick's question?
So, at this time, there is not enough information that's currently available to us to say, you know, if they should or should not get it, or even how long after infection someone is protected from getting COVID-19 again, which we refer to commonly as a natural immunity. So, early evidence that we have suggests that natural immunity from COVID-19 may not last long, but more studies are needed to better understand this. And until we have a vaccine available and the ACIP, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, makes the recommendations to CDC on how best to use the COVID-19 vaccine, it's very difficult to comment at this time whether people who had COVID-19 should get the vaccine.
Well, a lot of people don't know if they had it or not. So, are you recommending that they Do we get a hardcore answer to that question, or we do antibody testing for people before they're allowed to get the vaccine, or can we just rely on sort of horseback science, where we generally know that if you already had a disease and you get a vaccine for it, it's not going to do you any harm?
Exactly that. And again, there are so many things still unknown about this vaccine, but at this time, we are not recommending that folks get a test before get the vaccine. Now, if you have a history of having gotten contracted COVID-19, you know, we know that the protection from that natural immunity that's conferred with that natural infection is a finite duration, which is about 90 days. What we don't know is whether that immunity is going to last longer. So at this time, you know, I'm going to reserve commenting on that unless we hear back from the ACIP on what the recommendation is, which is still being under still being reviewed by them.
I have a question from email from Oscar. Would it be more prudent to wait until the Oxford vaccination, the Zeneca vaccine, which does not require such strict storage refrigeration that normal pharmacies and clinics have? Would that be smarter to do? Dr. Sandra Guetta?
I think that what we're going to see and what will come out onto the market and during the new year, after the new year in 2021, is we're going to start seeing a mix of different types of providers that are able to administer the vaccine will potentially have a different manufacturer that meets their needs, either from a distribution perspective, from a storage perspective, or the patient population that they are targeting. So I think that we're going to see that there will be some needs to have a variety, as we always have had, with different provider types out in the community administering the vaccine. Everything from governmental entities like the health department to other large institutions like health science centers to smaller places like a private doctor's office, and then national chains that include local pharmacies such as CVS or Walgreens or others that are all part of a very necessary vaccine distributing and administering opportunities.
But so this vaccine that that Oscar writes about doesn't have the high requirements for cold storage. It's just regular refrigeration. And we know this is a global problem. If we're thinking strategically, wouldn't it be better to try to steer the vaccine, as that is mass produced and it does take a while to do that, to areas of the world that doesn't have the infrastructure that we have here in the United States? Because they need it too, Dr. Guetta.
Absolutely. The entire world is really looking for the right solutions, and there will be different solutions for every part of the world. Even in within the United States and even within Texas, we have different abilities to store and to administer. So it will, you know, all healthcare is local. So what works locally, and that's what we're focused on in San Antonio, is making sure that when vaccine comes available, that it's reaching the right providers at the right time in order to be administered to the right people.
So back to the local infrastructure issue of the cold storage for the Pfizer vaccine, which is the one that has the highest requirements. And Dr., I think it was Dr. Anita Kurian, that you told me that we still need to muscle up for that here locally. So is that happening now, or what needs to happen?
So that is happening now, and CDC and the state is recommending to use the thermal shippers that these vaccines come in. So we are not urging healthcare providers to go stock up on these ultra-cold refrigerators just yet. The shipping boxes that they come in can be, the vaccines can be maintained in those, agreed for a finite period of time again, for up to 10 days with constant replenishment of the dry ice in those shipping packages. So those efforts, those education and training are being done to the providers. And I know some providers are already going out and getting those storage containers on their own as well, which is fine. But, you know, like Dr. Guerra was saying, as the weeks go by, months go by, we may have different vaccines with different storage requirements and shipping and handling capacities. So the recommendation is, you know, stay put. If you can, get it. If not, those thermal shipper boxes that the vaccines will be allocated in from the federal government or from the manufacturers directly could be used. But again, there are some constraints associated with that as well.
And Dr. Guerra, when the health department or whoever's going to be getting the vaccine directly from the manufacturer, you receive a product, but does it still need to be mixed and handled or somehow processed?
So most of the vaccines that we are understanding that we should be able to receive are going to come in a shipping container that can protect the temperature for several days and can be replenished from a dry ice and other kind of refrigeration back into the same container. So that is all great. And then when it is opened, then there is a timeline that is set to make sure that all the vaccines that have now been opened are administered. As far as mixing, and that's usually reserved for treatments of COVID more so than it is for vaccine. We may, depending on how they are shipped, have to draw them up from a vial, which is not unusual. That's what we do all the time with vaccines. Or they might be one-time dose. But either way, we will be prepared and we will make sure that we have everything that we need to make that happen. Recognizing that there will be a period of time that once it is opened, we need to have the patients ready to receive the immunization.
The second shot, is it just more of the first or is it something different, Dr. Guerra?
It is the same thing. It is the immunology terms, we call it a booster. It is something that is the same dose. It is usually the exact same thing. It's just happening at a delayed point in time from the first one. Like Dr. Wu said, 3 weeks, 4 weeks is the norm in order to ensure that your immune system recognizes and responds strongly if it is ever exposed again. So usually they are the same dose. Usually it's the same way that the first one was administered.
So that could mean that an individual who gets that first dose is still 6 weeks or longer away from being fully protected from being still infected with COVID-19. And so we still have to be very cautious and protect people during that time. So we can't let our guards down. We'll talk more about that, about who gets these shots here locally. How do we reach communities here in San Antonio who typically don't want to be reached? And what about some of the other questions about what happens at our schools and when do we all get to throw our mask away and go back to the movies? You can call in if you've got a question or comment. The number is 833-877-8255. 833-TPR-TALK. Dr. Sean, hang on. I'll get you right after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Oil is in trouble, and so is Texas. Hi, I'm Paul Flav. The Shakeout, TPR's podcast about the economic cost of COVID-19, takes you to the communities impacted the most.
We talk about here in Odessa and the Permian Basin that no matter what industry you're in, we're all in the oil industry together.
The bust is bad, but what comes next? You can find that episode and all of The Shakeout's work on Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get fine quality audio.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about COVID-19's vaccination implementation plan for here in San Antonio. We're hearing that before the end of December, we could have vaccinations here, but this is for high-risk medical personnel. And it won't be long after that that more will arrive, and it'll be going to other people who are at high risk, frontline workers. Eventually, there will be enough for everyone who wants one. But who wants one? Are you skeptical? Are you not really ready? Are you not eager to roll up your sleeve? I know I am. I can't wait to get my vaccine. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK for you to join the conversation. Let's go to our caller, and this is Dr. Sean Vina. Dr. Sean Vina, welcome to The Source.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
So our history of vaccination programs have been so successful because of national requirements. Polio was eliminated in part because we required students to have them in order to use public schools. And we saw that in the last couple of years, those outbreaks because of personal exemptions, and they kind of got rid of those things. Are we considering similar requirements for this, for say, students against public schools or any other mandatory things or to be able to boost the success rate of these COVID vaccinations? Thank you.
All right, Dr. Sean, thank you for that. That's a question that we probably can't answer, but tell us what you think, Dr. Anita Kurian.
So at this time, you guessed it right. It's not a mandatory program. It is completely voluntary, and especially and that's in the light that this is a new vaccine. This was a novel infection. We have a new vaccine. It's not been made mandatory yet. It's completely voluntary, and it can be administered to folks who choose to receive it.
But we do.
And again, that is at this time, and you know, information is constantly evolving, dynamic, changing. So, a big disclaimer: at this time, it is voluntary.
And Texas does not have a strict vaccination law. It does make it easy for parents to opt out of vaccinations if they choose to. But Dr. Sandra Guetta, Metro Health Interim Deputy Public Health Director, what is the percentage of the population getting inoculated for COVID-19 where we actually would see something like a herd immunity?
Well, thank you for that question. I think that's very difficult for us to say at this point because we will have a mix of people who either have some level of natural immunity, as well as those that are going to have hopefully a more long-lasting immunity due to a vaccination. But I think it'll be difficult for us to tell at the very beginning when we have reached a point of, for all intents and purposes, enough saturation that we can really rely on herd immunity and be able to start walking back from some of the things that we're having to do today, such as wearing a mask and having social isolation and limiting the number of people who are gathering. And that's the ultimate goal, that we can have an opportunity to return to a way of life that many of us remember and miss before we were in the pandemic. So I think there's a lot of different science around what it takes to truly have a herd immunity. It's usually at least half of the population in order to get us there, but obviously that's going to vary by population, even subsets of the population. Persons who are at high risk of having more severe illness or having continued exposure to COVID because they are a healthcare worker, there may need to be a higher index of needing to get that population immune and protected versus perhaps other groups that are less likely to have as severe of a reaction if they were exposed. So it's a complicated answer to a very tough question.
I've read that 70% might be what we're shooting for, to get 70% of the population inoculated.
That is correct. Yeah, 70 to 80% of a population should be immune before we could say that we have adequate herd immunity. And that may come eventually with when it comes to COVID-19, but my suspicion is it will take us a while to get there.
But as we know, we have pockets of the population who are reluctant to get vaccines already. We've seen that with measles and other whooping cough and other diseases that we thought we'd put behind us because of the anti-vaxxer movement. So, Dr. Guetta, these are communities where they could still be dealing with the COVID outbreak even after we have reached the high levels of herd immunity.
Absolutely. We recognize that there are groups of individuals throughout our communities that are either unwilling, unable, or for a variety of other reasons, not going to get a vaccine. And we have to be mindful of how to adequately protect them, regardless of what their choices are. I'm not going to be someone who judges someone over that. I hope that people will quickly have a good experience with the COVID vaccine, that they can reassure those hesitant communities about taking the vaccine so that we can start to move in the right direction when it comes to this. But we are going to continue to fight COVID as a very strong infection, lethal infection in our community for some time, even after the vaccine becomes available.
So a lot of people are looking at your plan. I mean, your plan is very similar to other communities' plans being led by the CDC's vaccination program playbook, the transparency of it, and that having high-profile communities, individuals that, of high trust to help lead the way so that we do have, I guess, are you looking for a high level of adoption and being able to deal with the misinformation that will be circulating in on the internet and things to dissuade people from taking the vaccine?
Yes, we recognize that there will always be a subset of the community that are not going to want to be vaccinated, either those that already exist as groups that believe all vaccinations are not healthy. There may even be new groups that develop specific around this vaccine. And so our goal is to make sure that, first off, we will be able to stand behind the safe and effective vaccine. Secondarily, to create messaging that is tailored to different groups, and including different ethnic groups, including different subsets of the population, and make sure that we tailor our messaging to make sure that it reaches out to them. We are also going to be hosting several information sessions and town halls to be able to answer questions publicly, and we're going to work with our trusted partners in the community to help us get the word out that this is the direction our community really needs to go for the safety of everyone.
Dr. Anita Kurian, as you look at the critical populations for a COVID-19 vaccine, earlier we said that the essential like healthcare workers will be first, and then who comes in after that? I mean, we know that people that we called essential workers during the pandemic, or will they be in front of the line?
That's correct. After the healthcare workers, we have folks who are non-healthcare critical infrastructure groups, and those are folks involved in your public safety, fire, education, food and agriculture industry. And then once those are addressed, that subset population is addressed, then we could look at other folks who are also being categorized as critical population groups, which are your folks living in congregate setting, people at high risk for COVID, for severe illness of COVID, such as your elderly, people with underlying medical conditions, and lastly, people with limited access to vaccination services. That's important. They are also categorized adults who are uninsured, underinsured, don't have sufficient access to healthcare, are also being categorized as critical population groups.
So so food workers are considered critical infrastructure, essential workers. Will you be working with maybe like HEB because they're checkout people? I mean, that's I'm grateful for everything they've done, and I want to help keep them safe.
Yes, absolutely. And one thing we should have mentioned early on was that this is unlike any other vaccination efforts that we've held in the past, where local public health department acted as a depot or a vaccine distributor, right? With COVID-19, because the vaccines are so fragile, what's going to happen is the vaccines are going to be shipped directly from the manufacturer to the providers. And HEB pharmacies are also considered as vaccine providers, and we are recommending and strongly urging everybody to register directly at the DSHS COVID-19 vaccine enrollment site to become a COVID-19 vaccine provider. And once you successfully enroll, and many, I can tell you, many of the HEB stores have enrolled, pharmacies have enrolled as COVID-19 vaccine provider. Once you do that, vaccination is going to be shipped, vaccine doses are going to be shipped directly from the manufacturer to the point of administration and address all these needs of those food and your grocery store workers.
All right. I know when I got my flu shot a couple of months ago, I needed like a day to sleep it off. Hopefully, if they give all the checkout workers and people at HEB the shots in the same day, I mean, that would be, I don't know, a way to stagger that so that we don't have to shut down HEB for a full day in San Antonio to deal with the vaccination. But if you got a question or a comment, you're just curious about something, how this could roll out, how it could impact you or your business, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The source continues right after this quick break. To The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about COVID-19's vaccination rollout plan for San Antonio. If you have a question, a comment, anything you're curious about, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. That's the number you can call. You can also text us at that number. Dr. Sandra Guerra, Metro Health Interim Deputy Public Health Director, what about the equity issue when it comes to making sure the vaccine gets out into the public? There are many, many people, particularly here in Texas, who do not have healthcare providers.
You're absolutely correct. And it is an extremely important part of the conversation and part of the planning that we are doing at San Antonio Metro Health in order to identify those areas that need vaccine providers and working collectively with those that are able to provide it. And if we are unable to really lock down a independent provider, then the health department will act as a provider and immunizer for that portion of the community, because equity is so important to us that we want to make sure everyone has equal and adequate access to the vaccine going forward.
Well, and for many people, that means, like, is it going to be free?
Yes, it is something that we recognize cost can be a barrier. At the moment, there is no expectation that the vaccine itself will actually cost people anything to get it. Now, some providers may choose to have an administration fee because of the work that goes into maintaining it and administering it. But other than that, the vaccine itself is something that should not be a barrier to anyone to get the vaccine.
So will the health department be having clinics in areas of San Antonio where we have people lost jobs, people are out of money, people are trying just to get by, even if it's a moderate cost that might be more than people can scrape up? I mean, how are we going to get free vaccines to the people?
Yes, San Antonio Metro is committed to being a provider of vaccine to people who have no other means to be able to get it. So that means that, yes, it will be administered, and it will be administered without cost to people. As the different priority groups roll out, our approach on how we're doing outreach and where we're doing outreach will continue to evolve Once we get to the general public piece, then absolutely San Antonio Metro will be hosting clinics that would be able to administer vaccine for free for people who show up.
And individuals who are in the country without authorization. They don't want to be deported, and they're reluctant to come into contact with the government on any sort of level, particularly because of the last 4 years of hostility. What are you going to tell those folks?
We definitely understand that what is important right now to our community, to our world as a whole, is really to protect the population. We are not interested in the nationality or any other information on people. We will be asking for things like addresses and phone numbers and things like that to do a follow-up and make sure that people are not having any untoward event or adverse outcome from the vaccine. But other than that, what we will be asking for people is to come forward, as we do with all our services, when they need them, which is in the best interest of everyone in the community.
So you're going to need some trust for that. Really?
Absolutely, we need trust. And we are trying to build that trust. First off, we have been in the community for a very long time, providing all different types of services to all different types of people. So that, in and of itself, we hope makes us a trusted partner to people. But we're also working with other organizations in the community that perhaps are even more trusted than we are, and asking for their assistance in outreach and in communication as we go through this process.
Dr. Junda Wu, this is an adult vaccine that's rolling out right now. I mean, what's the age range?
Yeah, so right now it is for adults. One of the companies has a study that does include up to down to age 16, and will be starting to look at youths ages 12 and up. But this is the usual way things roll out, is you first make sure it's safe on adults, and then you move on to children. I know the pediatric community is really concerned for that and advocating for that, and we are going to see that happen just at the next stage.
So that brings up a question about schools. If we're not giving it to children under 16 or 17, then schools can still be a place of high transmission if they let their guards down.
One thing that I wanted to comment about earlier is, you know, once you get the vaccine, you're not bulletproof. You still want to keep on masking and keeping a healthy distance, because it may reduce your risk, but it doesn't completely eliminate your risk of infection, right? So if we can reduce the risk in all of our society on the whole, then that seeps over into schools. So I'm reassured, I think, that we're going to be okay. One of the things we've noticed about schools, actually, is that so far we've had fewer outbreaks than we all expected at first. It's not zero. It's not a zero risk place, but it's not as high as we thought it would be in, say, a more other closed environment.
Sure. Schools have done an amazing job. I'm going to go to a caller. Kiyan, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello. How y'all doing?
Okay.
Hey, so I was reading online about an interesting idea. They were calling it like the vaccine stimulus check. What if we like paid people to get the vaccine, therefore kind of partially avoiding the people who might not get it because of, you know, financial reasons, or they don't believe in vaccines, or, I don't know, people are lazy maybe. I don't know. What do y'all think about
right.
that?
Right. That's a $1,200 incentive, a stimulus check if you get the vaccination. That does bring up some ethical questions, but that would be something that would be solved in Washington, D.C. Any thoughts on that, Dr. Sandra Guerra?
I think we are, as a community, I think a lot of those things are being explored to try to see what is the best pathway forward and what is the best use of limited resources, and trying to make sure that we are being creative on how we reach out to people and in all intensive purposes, make it be an easy and inviting opportunity for them to get their vaccine. At first, we will always move toward trying to encourage people to get the vaccine in a very voluntary, this is what is good for you, this is what's good for your family, this is good for your workplace type of approach. I think when you get to things like requirements or other more necessary steps is when we haven't seen a natural uptake in the vaccine as we would have liked, and then we maybe have to resort to more either requirements or other creative ways to get people to get the vaccine. I hope we won't be there. I hope that the world has seen the impact of this virus and recognizes the value that a vaccine brings to us as a whole. So I hope we won't get there. I hope we won't have to spend limited resources on that sort of initiative. But I've learned during this pandemic to never say never.
Let's go to Elizabeth on the phones. Elizabeth, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you, Dave, for another great program that benefits the common good. And blessed Thanksgiving to everybody at TPR. I had a question about the side effects of these vaccines to be expected.
All right. Dr. Junda Wu, the side effects from the vaccination.
Yeah. So for the Pfizer one, the main side effects were fatigue and headache after the second dose, and those were in less than 5%, like 2 to 3% of people. For the Moderna one, fatigue, muscle aches, joint pain, headache, pain at the injection site, redness at the injection site. Those are the ones that were severe. You know, and again, the most common side effects are the really mild ones that I mentioned earlier. Pain at the injection site and maybe some soreness, but severe meaning they had to take a medicine for it, for instance, or tired enough that you had to lie down like you did, Dave, with the flu shot. So with the Moderna one, those are in less than 10% of people, all of those side effects that I just read.
So I have a question from a text message. Assuming all goes well, 70-80% of the population is vaccinated with a good clinical response, what would you, when we move towards a normal, back to normal situation, Dr. Sandra Guetta, when do you think? I have about a minute left.
Sure. I wish I had a crystal ball and I could tell you that. I think we are going to spend most of 2021 still fighting the COVID pandemic. I hope that by 2022, life will start to ease up and return to normalcy.
So we're having a choke point, being able to manufacture all of these doses still at the level of quality that they need to be, the raw materials and the distribution, all these things are in flux. We don't know how soon we're going to be able to have all the doses that we want, but at least we know that we are at this point in the game, and maybe we can be talking about getting rid of this pandemic eventually. I want to thank all of our guests, Dr. Anita Kurian, Dr. Sandra Guetta, Dr. Junda Wu, all with the San Antonio Metropolitan Health District. Also, I want to thank all of our listeners as we go into Thanksgiving. Your support has kept Texas Public Radio and The Source on the air, and I am thankful for everything you have done to keep Texas Public Radio strong. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Ken Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by Ruben Garcia and Kathleen Creedon. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.